Good afternoon, everyone. My name's Gavin Wall, and I'm a Cloud Solution Architect with Microsoft. So I hope you enjoyed this morning's keynote, and there were probably a couple of things that you got out of it about building the intelligent cloud and architecture being key. And I guess as a long-time architect, today's session I'm going to take you through some of the lessons that I learnt as a customer prior to my last 12 months working with Microsoft, and some of the lessons I've also learnt in the last 12 months around Azure enrollment, management, governance, and reporting. Because it's very easy to get started with Azure, particularly when you jump straight into the management portal, you spin up virtual machines, you spin up all the cool stuff, right? But then when you sign up to it via your EA, you've got to work out the management and governance layers over the top of it and how to best take advantage of that to make your life easy, whether it be because you want to do chargeback, whether you want to just do showback, whether you just want to logically organize your workloads. So I'm going to take you through some of that today. So before a bit of an overview, just give me an idea of who I've got in the audience here. So who's from a customer? Cool. Who's from a partner? And any partners here delivering services under a managed service provider model? Awesome. Cool. I've got some content for you. So the session today, I'm going to start off by telling you what you need to know about using Azure under an enterprise agreement. Now, if you aren't using Azure under an EA, there's still some content here for you. But what I am finding, and you heard this morning, so 40% of Azure usage is attributed to startups and small and medium business. Right? And I find a lot of the customers that I'm working with nowadays may not have had an enterprise agreement in the past, but they've signed up to an EA because they want the cheapest way to get access to Azure and use Azure. So I'll run through what some of the benefits are, how it works, and there's also an MSDN dev test offer that helps out with your pre-production environments in Azure as well. Following that, I'm going to go through some recommended practices for structuring and governance of your Azure enrollment. So those lessons that I had to learn the hard way when I was a customer and what I've learned since. And I'll provide some example enrollment structures and recommended practices. Then another important part of it is estimating workload costs. So a lot of customers, when they're first starting out with Azure, are trying to work out, okay, how much is it going to cost me to put application X up there? And I don't want to run into bill shock. And typically you also have, in larger organizations, the guys from procurement involved who want to make sure that there's some controls and in place. And finally, as part of that, I'll take you through gaining insights from your usage reports. So starting off, how Azure works under an EA. So typically you start off by making an upfront commitment under your EA. Now that doesn't have to be big, it can be very small, and you can then pay for what you use on a quarterly basis. But whatever upfront monetary commitment you make, you just simply consume services from Azure, right? And it burns down on the meters and it consumes that Azure monetary commit. So that Azure monetary commit can be as little as, I think, $1,200 in Australia. So not a lot of money to commit upfront to get access to discounts and better pricing in Azure. Then as 12 months go on, you can pay annually for anything extra that you used on top of your Azure monetary commit. But if you use more than 50% extra on top of your Azure monetary commit, you start paying on a quarterly basis. So some of the companies I work with choose to make a small monetary commit and do pay-as-you-go on a quarterly basis. Other companies choose to make a big monetary commit because they do budgeting on a 12-monthly cycle anyhow, and they might want to get access to things like Store Simple and other deployment offers that are available when you make a bigger one. Best to speak to the sales guys if you want more information about the why, and I'll leave it there. So what if you work for an organisation or with organisations that use MSDN for licensing Microsoft applications in a pre-production sense? Well, earlier this year we launched an offer, so it went live in April, where you could set up your pre-production environments in Azure, flag them as MSDN accounts, and then you either pay the cheaper rate of your EA pricing or MSDN pricing. So things like machine learning and HD Insights are cheaper under MSDN. So no matter what, no matter which one's cheaper, you get the benefit of it there. The one thing that you do forego, because it is pre-production, is you forego your SLAs, right? So only use this for pre-production. Don't use it for production because your SLAs are part of the agreement. So how does that work? Well, it means you get one bill, right? So one bill for pre-production and production. Those MSDN Azure subscriptions that you get as part of your MSDN subscription, so the $150 or $200 that your developers and other IT pros might have in the organizations, they're great, but they're not really great for doing SIT or UAT testing and any sort of coordinated pre-production environment. So leave those as the playpens that the guys and gals can use to learn, and then do all your structured and controlled pre-production environments under your Azure enrollment. So how does that work? You've got to segregate your environments. So split up your pre-production and your production environments. You just flag your pre-production environments as ones that you want to take advantage of the MSDN offer under, and start deploying virtual machines and Azure websites and everything else the same way that you would through the management portal. So it's something that happens at a higher level. I'll show you an example of the differences in a moment. So let's talk about your Azure enrollment. And I keep on mentioning it, so I better explain what it is. Right? So an enrollment is, in effect, your tap, right, to the Microsoft Azure cloud. So it's the way that you get the best, most refreshing cloud out of that tap at the cheapest rates. And conveniently, it gives you one single consolidated bill for everything that you do in Azure. Those are managed by enterprise administrators via the Azure EA portal. And underneath that, there's a few layers of management and governance. And then the next bit that I'll cover off is subscriptions, which is where you create all the cool stuff. All right. So in a lot of organizations, it's going to make sense for you to have multiple subscriptions, right? You might do it for workload or environment segregation. So you might go, okay, application X is going to be in one subscription, application Y in another. You might want to have dev, UAT, and production in different subscriptions. Then there's also logical or administrative boundaries. So what I find is if I'm working with an organization that traditionally has separated dev, UAT, and production into different virtual networks, or they have other network boundaries that they implement, because it tends to become a good logical boundary or border for you to go and put things into a different subscription. Now, having said that, you don't want to have hundreds and hundreds of subscriptions. Use them wisely. And the subscriptions are each managed by a service administrator, and that service administrator has the same rights as the 199 other co-administrators who have full admin access to a subscription. So hopefully you don't have anywhere near that number of administrators in your Azure subscriptions. Earlier this year, we GA'd something called role-based access control. So it allows you to give a lot more granular access to sets of resources and resource groups within Azure using the preview portal or using our other management functions. Yep. So I'll show you some examples and then remind me the question. And for the benefit of people listening back on the recording, the question was, how complex can your enrollment structures get? I'll show you some examples and then hopefully that helps out. And if not, prompt me again. So when you're given access to an Azure subscription, you access them via the Azure Management Portal. Now, we've got two in play at the moment. There's the Classic Management Portal and there's the Preview Portal. Right? Now, one thing to remember is when you log into these portals, you see every subscription that you have been given access to via that identity that you logged in with. Right? So you're not going to different portals or different query strings at the end of a website to actually access a specific subscription. But what you can do when you log into those management portals is you can filter down and pick, okay, this is the subscription I'm going to work in. And I will cover off identity in a little bit more detail later on. So, the first of a couple of our management and governance layers. So, under an EA, we use accounts to group subscriptions together. You actually get an account when you sign up for a credit card billing statement as well, for a credit card subscription as well. So this is where some of the similarities come into play. Remember though, it's not a user account, right? This is a utility account. And the number one challenge that I find with customers and partners that are first starting out with Azure under an EA is when you went into the old EA management portal, the most prominent button on the page was add an account, right? And that was an Azure account rather than a user account. So they go, okay, Joe needs access to this Azure thing as well, right? Or maybe the guy from procurement got the email and they just went, oh, I'll just add an account for the guys in IT and they can deal with it later. But what's not necessarily apparent when you start that chain is you're creating an Azure account. The guy or gal that you created that account for gets an email saying, hey, welcome to Azure, here's your account. And they click the link that they're provided with and they go, okay, I'm into the portal now, and it says add a subscription. So what ends up happening is you have all of these separate Azure accounts for all these different people that you've given access to Azure with all of these subscriptions all named in the same way. So it's a fine scenario if you're a one-man band, but when you've got a bit larger team, it can become a little bit unwieldy. And I'll show you an example of that shortly. A key point to make about accounts, right? They're managed via the account portal, and accounts only have a single account owner. Right? So I'll give you some suggestions on how you tackle this a little bit later on. Key thing to remember as well is you don't want to make that account owner someone that has, or the identity that already owns, a BizSpark or an MSDN Azure subscription. If you do that, it actually pulls those subscriptions in under this EA account, and all of a sudden that $150 or $200 worth of playpen is in under your EA, right? Which is great because they have an almost unlimited playpen. So the final governance layer that we added just earlier this year is departments. Now departments are really just a label. Now the great thing that I love about departments is you can set up a department. A department contains one or more accounts. And you can set these, the cost center, a name, and a spending quota. And what happens with that spending quota is you'll get a notice at the 50% spend mark, the 75% spend mark, the 90% spend mark, and 100% spend mark. Now, when you hit 100%, it's not going to turn stuff off, right? Because we don't know what you want to do when you hit that limit. But it gives you that notification that says, hey, you're approaching this limit. Do you need to do something about it? So those are really the...
Is that where you get the spend limits? You don't get them on accounts?
So the question is, do you get spend limits on accounts? If you go into the account portal, you can actually set up some limits at a subscription level as well. I'm trying to remember what you could actually trigger with those. But yes, you're right, you can do it at that level as an account owner. So, when we start running you through Azure enrollments, normally we show you a picture much like this. I've actually simplified it down somewhat. But this gives you an overview of the logical structure. So you've got your enrollment up top, managed through the EA portal by enterprise admins. Your enterprise admins set up departments. If you're not using departments, your enterprise admins set up the accounts as well. Your department admins manage the departments. They can set up the accounts underneath that, the account owners set up the subscriptions. They can also retire subscriptions if you no longer need them. And one of the most important things that the account owners need to do is they actually need to rename subscriptions, because by default, the subscription is called Windows Azure Enterprise. And when you're looking at usage reports, and everything's been built against Windows Azure Enterprise, it can be a little bit hard to work out what you're actually using. And so as I mentioned, account owners, account portal, service admins and co-admins, and anyone that's got access via role-based access control, work via the management portal. So in our setup material, we do provide a few different methodologies around department and accounts you can think about. So functional, now this might be useful if you want to do chargeback based on, say, business departments. You could do it by business division, and you could do it by geographies as well. Now, I do have one customer that actually uses multiple enrolments under their EA, and they do that because they want different subsidiaries to actually get a different bill. So it makes the scenario a little bit more complex, but it means that they don't do the internal chargeback themselves. The benefit of putting everything for one organisation under one enrolment means that all that monetary commit that you put in up front is pulled across everyone, right? And then you just need to use some of the facilities like departments to do that chargeback. So typically I come across four example enrolment structures, right, that most organisations use. The first one, which I did allude to earlier, is the who reads the guide model, right? So the first person that's got that email about welcome to Azure, go into the EA portal and set up your Azure enrolment, has gone, okay, I'm just gonna give John and then Jim and then everyone up to John, again, access to an Azure account. And then what happens is they follow the email links and they go and set up separate Windows Azure Enterprise named subscriptions. So there's nothing wrong with using accounts on an individual basis if that suits your organisation, but you probably want to rename those subscriptions to something logical and succinct. The one I see used most often is where you've got a centralised IT department who is acting as that service broker to the rest of the business. They don't want shadow IT to necessarily run off and do their own things. They want to be the cloud broker. They want to facilitate everything they can. And in that scenario, I kind of see two camps. Right? And I find that those two camps are best represented by departments. So you've got your traditional infrastructure and your operations guys who want to continue being the service broker for virtual machines, for storage, for networking, right? And even act as a service broker to applications guys and developers who want to deliver a service that relies on infrastructure as a service offerings. And in those scenarios, sometimes I might see the subscriptions being split up in dev, UAT and prod. I've got a few other subscription breakdowns suggested here as well. But then you've got the other camp, the applications guys, right? They're getting more agile. They want to work towards DevOps processes. So typically that means they don't want to put in a self-service request or a service ticket to have someone from infrastructure or operations spin up a server for them. Or they just want to take advantage of all the PaaS offerings that we have on Azure and take out the infrastructure layer entirely. So in those scenarios, I tend to see this sort of breakdown. Because the apps guys are more likely to have MSDN subscriptions, a lot of those pre-production environments are licensed under the MSDN offer. So you'll see here that, in this case, the dev test account has been ticked as subscribing to that MSDN offer, and that's actually where you do that allocation, is you go into the EA portal and you go into the settings of that account and just tick a little box that says, okay, this is an EA offer, a test MSDN test dev offer account. Right. And then when it comes to subscription breakdown, I tend to see applications being used as a subscription border. The SharePoint guys, if they're building their SharePoint add-ins for SharePoint Online or SharePoint On-Premise, also tend to have a subscription that they use to back-end a lot of their SharePoint add-ins and offerings. Not the only subscription models that I see happen when it comes to PaaS services, though. So the next one that I come across frequently, particularly in government where you've got lots of service providers and outsourcers and right sourcing happening, is this model. So in this scenario, the customer's purchased Azure, but they want their service providers to partner with them and deliver services on top of their own Azure pre-commit. So I find the department functionality can be good in this scenario. So a service provider or a vendor is set up as a department. You might do some budgeting, so you might define some of that spend limit against that department. And then at an account level, I find what tends to happen is you line the accounts up to service offerings that that service provider is actually delivering for you. So in this case, I've got an example SiteCall one, and I've got a SharePoint example as well. Right? And then vendor B might be taking care of all the traditional infrastructure as a service, so VM, storage, networking, etc. Now, in this scenario, if the customer goes, okay, this SiteCall project is coming out of its project phase and it's about to go into the operational phase, and I want vendor B to manage that for me now. And one of the things you can do is you can go into the EA portal, you can go to that account, and you change the department that's allocated to that account. So straight away, that's going to move SiteCall out from vendor A across to vendor B. So from a reporting perspective, that lines up and will flow through in your usage reports. What you will still need to do is you will still need to go into those subscriptions and update the management roles and change the identities that have been allocated there. So it makes it simpler, but it doesn't do the whole thing for you around changing over that management. And here's one that I'm coming across more recently, which is managed service providers. So this is where a service provider has signed up for Azure to deliver services for customers using their own Azure subscription. So in this scenario, we're a bit more prescriptive about how you set up the departments and accounts. So the guidance is to set up a department per customer you're delivering to. And when you set up that department, you put in the customer name, you can put in the other details, and you flag that as an MSP department, right? And put in some other extra contact information. So what that does is, I don't know whether you're familiar with the certifications around silver and gold partners, that actually helps tick over your accreditation against the silver and gold status. Right? And if you're in that scenario, there's probably some extra information that your partner manager can provide. Yes, question.
So with the coming CSP program, which one of these models is used?
That I don't know yet. So the question was, with the coming CSP program, which of the models are used? I honestly don't know yet. Because CSP is kind of an evolution of MSP, I expect it to line up like this, but I haven't seen the internal guidance yet. I'm going to bring the other microphone down because I'm not going to be able to repeat that question.
So if you have an MSDN license for pre-production,
yep,
that model there under customer A or customer B wouldn't accommodate that?
So that's where it's getting into the grey and murky area, and I'd say speak to a licensing specialist, just on the basis that if you're licensing your pre-production environment with MSDN, there will be some limitations as to third parties and customers coming in and accessing that environment. So you might still be able to use it for, say, the dev environment that you don't give access to the end customer in, but worth asking a licensing specialist exactly whether that's legit or not, because not a problem. Is there any other questions at this point?
IT is a broker model, the first one.
Yep.
Where you had, you know, use an MSDN account for the account. The MSDN subscriptions use like a, you know, another EA, it's a name sort of email. But how do you apply that to like a generic account called apps when you might want to give like
I'll
six
show you
developers?
That. Yep. Well, I may not show you it, but I'll certainly talk to it in a couple of slides. Okay, so where does Azure AD come in? And I think, thankfully, Brad, I think, nailed this in the keynote this morning, so I won't need to speak to it as much. But essentially, you've had Windows Server AD on-premises for years. You've used it as your identity provider for years, and you're defining your own password policies, your own a whole heap of security policies that you want to extend out to the cloud. Right? So extend them out to the cloud using using Azure AD Connect or Azure Sync, Azure AD Sync, and then use Azure AD to manage and control identity for your enrollment, your departments, your accounts, and your subscriptions. Now, something that I quite often have to point out with the organisations I work with is don't think of Azure AD as something that you spin up inside a subscription, right? So it's not like a virtual machine. It's not bound to a single subscription. Azure AD is identity as a service, and it spans everything that you create under Azure, if you so choose. And you can use it against those 2,500 different SaaS services that Brad showed in the keynote. Now, where this can become interesting under the MSP model, and I think it's going to be the same under the CSP model, is, well, how do you use Azure AD in a scenario where you're delivering a service to multiple managed multiple customers under an MSP model? So I'm not going to give you the answer because I think it's one that you have to weigh up the pros and cons yourself, but one model would be you use the same Azure AD to manage identities and access to subscriptions and accounts across all customers. The other model would be you can set up separate Azure AD, and perhaps you don't even need to synchronise these to AD on-premise for different customers. Right? If you're using Azure AD by itself, you can still define some of those password policies. You can still turn on two-factor authentication. So there is some merits to going a separate Azure AD per customer, but really you've got to weigh up those pros and cons and look at it from a security and risk perspective. Okay, so recommended practices. Use service accounts instead of people accounts, right? And this comes back to that question a moment ago. So what I do when I get service accounts set up is create them in Windows Server AD, let them synchronize up to Azure AD, and I set the email address to be a distribution list for all the Azure administrators, right? So you can do specific groups of people if you really want, but the key thing is you want that DL tied to that account owner's service account so that you get notifications and other important information from Microsoft around the services that you're using under that account. Another one, it's sometimes a little bit hard when you first get started in Azure, particularly if you haven't got Office 365 and Azure AD and that identity framework in place already, but try and avoid the use of Microsoft accounts. So a Microsoft account, so whether it be a Hotmail, whether it be an Outlook.com, whether it be a Live.com, is not in your control. Right? It's not following the same password policies. Yes, you can turn on two-factor authentication, but if you're using those accounts to manage access to Azure subscriptions and so forth, you're really leaving the door a little bit ajar. Because if that person leaves the organisation and you don't have control of that account, you want to be damn quick in, not that, I mean, we're all IT guys. We're not malicious in any way whatsoever, but there's always that risk, right? The other one, turn on MFA.
Quick question, I'll yell out. What happens if a Azure account is deleted that a subscription is under?
Okay, so the question was, what happens if an Azure account is deleted that a subscription's under? If it's got stuff that you care about, say production stuff, then your first course of action is contact your support, whether that be Premier support through Microsoft, whether it be one of the support offerings that you've signed up to. And worst case scenario, for an incident like that, you just put in a billing ticket, which is everyone gets for an Azure subscription. So they can essentially bring that account back, right? It goes into a semi-staging area, and the quicker you get onto it, the better. But that's why it's important to secure your identities. Right? Brad nailed it this morning when it's the identity is the perimeter. Right? So turn on MFA, use Azure AD. Even if you don't buy Azure AD Premium or EMS, you still get some of the reporting functionality around authentications to Azure AD. So use that information and, I guess, be proactive in that regard. Yep.
You've got a comment about losing an account.
Yep.
What happens if you actually want to move a subscription from one account because you actually need to deprecate
it? Yeah, so if you want to move a subscription, question was, what happens if you want to move a subscription from an account? So in the EA portal, we actually have a facility now to move a subscription from one account to another. In fact, if you've actually already set up, say, your accounts aligned to people, and you go after this talk, you go, okay, I want to change them to use service accounts, what you actually need to do is you go and set up another account in the under your enrollment and set the account owner to be, say, that service account. And then you go, I'll show you in the portal in a moment, if you remind me, but you go and click the button to transfer ownership. So you can pick the subscriptions underneath a particular account and move them across to another account. It's something that we've only been able to do self-service for in the last month or two. Makes it a lot easier though. And even though you have that facility now, which does make it easier to transfer ownership from one person to another, I still recommend going with service accounts. Because if that person's not around and you realise, oh, hey, this project says they really need an Azure subscription and they've given me all the right reasons for creating a separate Azure subscription, but the person that is the owner is away, right? You're going to have to go through the kerfuffle of creating another account and then cleaning things up later, So I still recommend going that service account model. Yes?
One more quick question. If somebody starts up a subscription under a credit card, for
yep.
instance, and then wants to move it under an EA agreement, that same process can still be done?
Similar process. So question was, if I've got a credit card subscription and I want to transfer it under the EA, what do I do? So similar transfer process, except you do have to log a ticket with our support. So it's one of those free billing tickets. Or if you want it done a little bit quicker and you've got Premier Support or one of the other support offerings for Azure, you can log it in that method. So log a ticket, tell them who the account owner is, the subscription, including the GUID that you want to move, tell them where you want it to go to and provide enough information for them to trust what you're saying, and then they'll transfer that across for you. Now, in that scenario, what happens is, while it's under the credit card account, it keeps on getting billed against that credit card. Once it's transferred under the EA, the usage charges start getting accumulated against your enrollment. However, you'll get the monthly or quarterly bill with that kind of final, here's what you used against your credit card subscription up to that point in time when the transfer occurred. So it's not a painful process at all. It's just there's some things to keep in mind. The other thing I recommend is turn on multi-factor auth for all owners and admins. Right? So even when you're using a service account, there's a couple of ways that you can do multi-factor auth. One that I've seen used in one of the customers I work with is they actually bind that second factor to the on-call mobile phone. The other one is use the Azure AD MFA Authenticator app, and the people that might need to log in as that service account have that owner set up in their MFA app. And finally, and I think I've touched on this a little bit earlier, is give accounts and subscriptions meaningful, so product or service-oriented names. Make them succinct, but the more meaningful you can make in that, the easier it is to interpret your usage data down the line. And to that point, when it comes to usage data, we also have tag support in Azure now for compute, resource groups, cloud services, storage accounts, and so forth. So using tags can also help you work out where the spend, where the usage is going. But setting up a good enrollment structure to start off with makes that whole process that much easier. Okay, estimating workloads. I promise you a demo in a moment. So we've got a couple of tools for estimating workloads. One is the pricing calculator on Azure.com. Good, they're doing lots of enhancements to it. It generates pricing at retail prices. The other one is the Microsoft Azure Cost Estimator tool. Right. So I can talk about it, or I can show you, so I'm going to show you. So it's got a couple of functions. Right. The first one is If you're familiar with the map tool, where you can go and scan your environment and collect a whole heap of data back, one of the features of the map tool now is you can do it for assessing your environment for Azure as well. But with this cost estimator tool, it's specifically been built for the job. So you can go and scan your environment. Right, you can connect it up to VMM, to Hyper-V, to vCenter or ESX, or you can just point it at specific servers themselves. And it'll scan that environment, understand the properties of that environment, how much CPU, how much RAM, how much storage is attached to it, how much network traffic going between machines and out on the NIC, and it'll start coming up with an estimate for how much it would cost for you to move those workloads into Azure. So this is great for existing infrastructure as a service workloads you're running. You can run it continuously. And if you run it continuously, the cost-optimized model that it'll spit out for you is going to be better because it's going to be based on how much compute, how much memory you're actually really using on a regular basis. Now, we also have an alternate version of this tool that you can run on your existing Azure environments for that same purpose, to work out whether you've right-sized your Azure deployments themselves. So the other way that you can use this tool is by configuring services and scenarios and generating cost estimates. So I've got a few pre-canned cost estimates I've created, but if I wanted to do a new one, I can do add new cost estimate. All right, I add the scenario, and if I go across to services, let's say I wanted to spin up an app service in Australia Southeast. It's going to be on the premium plan. I'm going to have two P2 instances. I'm going to add that to my scenario. And helps if you put the right number of hours in too. So what I'm speccing up here is essentially our default configuration for an application service environment. Right? So that is essentially a premium version of our app service that you can sit onto a virtual network. Right? So I'll go across to my cost estimate now. You'll see the components that I've added, right? This is generating pricing in retail pricing as well. I'm using an internal version of this tool, but the public version of the tool only allows you to generate them in retail pricing. So if you want to convert that into your EA pricing, what you can do is look up your price sheet in the EA portal and just swap the numbers out. Right? So the question is there an enhancement coming to plug your EA values into it? I can't answer for sure, but given that we've got a price list API and a billing API, as someone in the field working with customers regularly, I would love to have a public facing version of this tool that takes that data out of your Azure enrollment, reflects the pricing that you pay, and generates an estimate for you. So I've saved my estimate, I can generate an estimate now. It'll spit out a Excel workbook in effect. All right. And away we go. Right. So I can then go in and edit that Excel spreadsheet and provide it to an end customer or an internal project or department. The other one to be mindful of when it comes to the cost estimator is make sure you pick the currency that you're working in. So if you're working in Australian dollars, pick Australian dollars. By default, it'll go to the US currency. Yeah, wrong one. Okay, and we've already seen the demo. All right, so usage reporting. Cool. Now, I've spoken for ages, so why don't we jump straight back into a demo? So in this case, I'll demo the EA portal, because about July, we released version 2 of the EA portal. It fixed up a lot of the idiosyncrasies that I spoke about earlier, where add account was the most visible and prominent function on there. So we'll flick over. There we are. So when you first log into the EA portal, so ea.azure.com, you go straight into the reports and you get a really nice clean view of your usage. All right, so this blue line here is your monetary commit. So you can see in this case, this one's quite high. The green down here is how much the customer or organization is using on a monthly basis. So you can see from here in September, they utilized 238K worth of Azure. If you want to swap into quarterly views because you're paying as you go on a quarterly basis, let's say, and you want to be able to track what invoice is going to come in, you can just flick across to quarterly. A tip for anyone that's on an indirect enterprise agreement, and that's if you don't know whether you're on a direct enterprise agreement or an indirect enterprise agreement, that's a question for the licensing guys or your account management team. But sometimes on the indirect agreements, the reseller hasn't actually put some information into their partner portal. So if they hadn't put that information in, you don't get to see your price sheet. And if you don't see your price sheet, you can see how many units you've consumed, but you can't see how much it's cost. So if you don't see that price sheet option, go to your licensing partner and ask them to do some setup for you. And the other couple of things that you see here when it comes to reporting is you can download usage reports. So if what you're getting in the portal isn't enough, you can download various reports. You can download some basic ones, but I tend to jump straight back into the advanced report download. So you can select the date range, right? You can select the accounts that you want to generate a report from. It'll go and process that data and give you a download link. Right? And then you can take that data and do with it as you wish. I'll give you some suggestions in a moment. In fact, I'll give you some of those suggestions now. So until recently, I had to do reporting in this way. So I used to download the usage data manually or automatically, put it into Excel, open up that Excel file, delete the first couple of rows because the information really isn't useful in those first couple of rows, turn on filters, right? And then I import that data into a Power Pivot model. Once it's in the Power Pivot model, because by default the dates used are the US format dates instead of the ISO international standard dates, I'd create a calculated column for those dates. And the reason why I need to do that is so I could see the daily usage pattern. And then I created with Power View these wonderful dashboards. So a simple, this is how much you're using on a daily basis, understanding the trend. And with things like Power BI, you can actually do forecasting on that to get a better idea of what your spend might be. And another simple but powerful report I find is just the breakdown by service, right? So I find for customers that are mainly doing infrastructure as a service and a little bit of PaaS, 80% of their costs are compute, right? Normally less than 10% of storage, right? It might be different for some customers that have a lot of store simple. And then less than 5% is most of the other stuff. Now, I can't hand on heart say that's going to be the case for all your customers or yourselves, but those are the type of patterns that you start to see when you've got access to data like this. And then, of course, you can break the data down by service, by account, by subscription, by tags, if you're using tagging as well. Once you've got that data out, it's a wealth of opportunity. And then 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, we released the Azure Enterprise Power BI content pack. Right? So that allows you to take the data out of your Azure enrollment and plug it straight into Power BI. Brilliant. Right? So all of that little process that I had to describe that I might have done when I was a customer on a monthly basis that took half an hour, right, is done on a daily basis automatically. So we'll swap across and I'll show you what one of these look like. So I want some ticks from the data platform guys for showing off Power BI in the Azure session as well. But so here, powerful, effective. So this is just a demo one, but if I wanted to set up a new one, it's just a matter of clicking Get Services, right, from our catalog, selecting Microsoft Azure Enterprise, connect. Now, unless you're using Azure in China, that's the address it's always going to be. You pick the number of months' worth of data that you want to bring through. So let's say one. And you put in your enrollment number. And then hit next. On the next page, you need to provide an authentication key. Now, even some of my colleagues have asked me, OK, where do I get this API key from? Because in the new EA portal, we did hide it a little bit. So if you go back to the EA portal, download usage, you'll see that there's a link here to access the API access key. I won't click it because it'll show you a very long string, and whilst I'm sure you won't be able to see the whole string, someone might get upset. So that's where you find it. So once you do that, it's going to start pulling all that data in. And we'll go back to my report. And then you end up with a report that looks like that. So straight out of the box, it gives you the data that you have access to. It gives you a dashboard set up pretty much exactly like this. Cost and total cost have been renamed, because I think by default they call those fields extended cost. Right? But very simple, very effective. Straight away you're getting an idea of where your spend is going when it comes to Azure. Gives you the number of accounts, the number of subscriptions, so you get a bit of an idea. Gives you some information on where those services are actually located. So you'll see there's some in Southeast Asia, some in North America in this scenario, Europe, in a lot of our data centres, none in Australia or the new regions in India though. Then if you want to drill into anything in particular, so I'm going to pick this one, it'll take you down to one of two out-of-the-box reports that it has. Yes?
Your pre-commit,
yes,
if you buy it under your EA agreement,
yep,
that is calendar year rather than financial year, catches people out. Is there any way to warn on that when you're getting in the reporting?
The way I've done this previously is, again, with Power Pivot, I've put that data into my own model, and I've shown the burn down against the commit. So the commit typically gets lined up against your EA year, which isn't necessarily your financial year. It isn't necessarily Microsoft's financial year. It could be November through to the next October. So from that perspective, yeah, it can be a bit finicky. There is a partner tool that prior to the new EA portal was a good way to get some of these nice visualizations out. That partner tool actually does some prediction about when you'll run out of monetary commit, and it's free in beta. So I'll provide some details on that in a moment. So here's the standard out-of-the-box couple of reports provided. So one that breaks things down by cancelled subscriptions and another that breaks it down by services. So I haven't had to configure these reports at all. It's just come all out of the box, and it's updated on a daily basis just by the sync that I've set up. Question?
The dates seem to be sorted in alphabetical order, not in actual date order.
Yeah, OK, so the comment was the dates are in alphabetical order rather than date order. I mean, this went live 3 weeks ago, so hopefully they'll clean up stuff like that. That was another reason when I was doing my own reporting that I used to go and put that ISO date format in, because it just made it easier to work with dates. Go and have a play with this, right? you don't have to have Power BI Pro to use this content pack, right? So you can sign up, and if you're already got Office 365 in your organization, just log into powerbi.com using the same account that you use for Office 365, and it'll just set up a free version of Power BI. So anyone can do this. Okay, so I did mention a little while ago our REST APIs that we published for Azure Billing and the Rate Card. So they were announced at Build. Scott Guthrie announced those. And when he made that announcement, he also spoke about two partners that that partnered up with us to take advantage of those. So Cloudyn was one. They integrate with the Billing API to do some more advanced financial management. And we'll actually give you some insights on cost optimization. And then the other one was Cloud Cruiser. So Cloud Cruiser actually uses the rate card and helps you predict, like the estimators earlier, how much it might cost you to move a workload into Azure. A couple of other reporting tools. So the one I was referring to around when's my monthly commit going to run out is the Redify Azure EA Insights. Right? So it's free to use, it's in beta, or it was last time I checked. Very simple to use. You set it up much the same way as the Power BI content pack. So you put in your enrollment number, you put in the API key, and it does the visualizations for you, so that's one of the visualizations. Another one that a lot of our customers use is Hanu Insights. So it is a paid for tool. Used for increased governance and financial management. So if you need to do more than what you think you're going to be able to do in the EA portal, you can look at Hanu Insights or any of the other partner offerings in that regard. And I actually think, whilst I haven't named them, we've actually got some Australian-grown partner offerings that are taking advantage of the rate card and the billing APIs as well. So, probably running 5 minutes early. Plenty of time for questions, but as a summary, I hope I've given you just enough information about how Azure enrollments work under your enterprise agreement. I hope that you can take on board one or two of those recommended practices and it makes your life easier in your Azure journey. And I hope you find those estimation and reporting tools of value. So, with that, I'll leave it there and open up for questions and remind you about completing your session eval for prizes. Thanks, guys. Any more questions?
Is there any best practice around if you create a DMZ subscription of whether to apply that under a separate account from the rest of your production environment or not? Is there any security concerns that would make you want to do that?
Not from my perspective. So when I look at a DMZ, I look at it as something that you'd implement in a more often than not in that infrastructure as a service side of the world. I'd be more than comfortable putting that DMZ virtual network or subscription in under the same account as my other infrastructure as a service. Something that I didn't point out, but perhaps it'll comfort you when I do, is the account owners themselves, the enterprise admins themselves, don't have access to any of the technical stuff that you spin up in Azure unless you grant them access. Right? So the account owner by default is the first service admin on a subscription. But if you decide, hey, this account owner shouldn't have access, because we're using a service account as an example, you go, okay, this account owner doesn't need access to that subscription. You go and change the service admin to someone or something else. So from my perspective, no reason not to do it in the same account.
So is that a best practice in itself that you shouldn't?
Let
the account owners be subscription?
I'll leave. Sorry. So the question was, is it best practice in itself to not have the account owner as the service admin? So personally, from my perspective, I find it simpler if the account owner is left as the service admin, because that way you always know, okay, the account owner is going to have access to the subscriptions underneath. But if you wanted to lock things down a little bit more, as in the case of the DMZ scenario, then you could do that.
Often the manager's going to actually be that top-level owner, and would you want to give them rights down below?
So often the manager's the top-level owner, would you want to give them access below? So when you say top-level owner, you mean the account owner?
Yes. So
I guess that's really a decision for your organisation as to whether you trust that manager to have access to the technical, the cool stuff underneath. They probably don't need access. Right? And that's again where if you use a service account rather than an actual person or a manager in this case, then they don't have access. And if you really wanted to, you could put more reporting and alerting on top of, hey, tell me when this service account is actually used, because it shouldn't be used that regularly. All stuff that you can do with Azure AD. Any other questions, guys?
any implications for Express Route?
Any implications for Express Route? Yes, there is. So by default with Express Route, you can connect it to 10 virtual networks. If you use ExpressRoute Premium, you can connect it up to 10 different virtual networks. So this is where I'd say when it comes to your subscriptions, don't break your subscriptions up any more than you would break up your virtual networks, right? And part of the reason is, well, keep things simple, but also so that you're not approaching those border limits for ExpressRoute circuits, right? Or connecting an express route circuit to virtual networks. So,
just a quick one on that. Does a VNet only live in, so if you've got more subscriptions, it's the number of VNets?
So,
important, or does the subscriptions count in
this? So, the question was around subscriptions and VNets. So, a VNet exists in a single subscription. A VNet itself cannot span multiple subscriptions, but what you can do is say you go, okay, I'm going to have a logical network separation between, well, you have to do it. Say you're going to spin up Azure services in Australia Southeast and Australia East, right? A virtual network exists in a single region. If you wanted to connect those two networks together, you'd have to do either a site-to-site VNet connection, or sorry, a VNet to VNet connection. So similar to a VPN, or you connect them both up to the same express route circuit and they'll get connectivity. But so
that's why you keep your subscriptions to the minimum.
Yeah. So use them for logical separation, use them for admin separation, but don't overuse them. So just to clarify finally there, VNet only exists in one subscription and it cannot span subscriptions. Anything more, guys? All right, I'll be around at the speaker lounge afterwards. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining me.